It can only be a kind of central son of the rising father. But what about the philosophic man is not a descendant from an oligarchic father? Do you see that? The ordinary, say, the craftsman or poor farmer, he is not the degenerate son of an oligarchic father. He is not the son of an oligarchic father at all. And this fiction that the democratic man, the typical representative of democracy, must be the degenerate son of an oligarchic father, that disturbs and that ruins our own picture. In the other case, it works in this transition from aristocracy to democracy to oligarchy, but not in the case of democracy, unless you say, which has some relevance, but which is of course not simply true, that the typically democratic man is the demagogue who deserves his class. I mean, as some people thought, F.D. Roosevelt, you know, this kind of thing. And but even if you look at the same as I see in demagogues, it would be true of Pericles, it would not be true of Cleon, of course. You know, Cleon came from the lower class, obviously. And that distorts the whole picture. Yes.
In the banquet, you know the story of Porros, of the rich and poor poverty, generally Kerouac.
Yeah. Yes. That would be a consequence. I could not unravel that at such a short notice. Do you have any reason? All right. Perhaps we take it up next time when we come to the present? Yeah. Good. Yes. The data is not available to me because of that. this is a question. In this case, in the first transition from the aristocratic man to the democratic man, we know that the aristocratic man is not a member of an aristocratic regime, but of some bad which is not a part. We should observe, are there any specifications as to the regime in which the democratic man lives, who gives birth, as it were, to the oligarchic man, and the same in all other cases? That has to be done carefully. I haven't done it. That would surely be interesting. But the main result is clear. The simple coordination of regime and individual does not quite work. And that is only a reminder of the generally we know a long time, that this coordination is a playful premise of the Republic. And the clearest proof, I believe, is this, that it is evidently sound to say that the spirited element should rule over the element of desire in the polis, namely that the soldiers, the people protecting the country, dedicating their lives to it, should have a higher status than those concerned only with their service. That makes sense. But it does not easily make sense to say that in the individual, the element of anger is as such superior to the element of desire. And my simple example is that the child desires the doll or whatever it is, that's desire. And then he or she doesn't get the doll, and then he or she becomes angry. His anger is in a way morally lower than the original desire. So that of a universal superiority of one cannot speak possibly of a universal and essential superiority of anger to desire. But in the political context, it makes sense. Yes?
Is there no other term to use for
it? Yeah, anger is surely too narrow because it comprises many more things. I mean, but anger is, how shall I say, the basic, the primary phenomenon of these things.
So, would there be no way to put in some ideas such as natural, ardency?
Yeah, but why should this be so similarly superior?
In order to, well, the thing is, I'm not sure that I'd be too fatal in saying that one reason why this might be so infinitely superior is in this respect the man would then be keeping with it.
Yeah, but that doesn't work, and I will give you a simple external proof that in the other dialogues where Plato speaks of this kind of thing, especially in the Phaedrus, the chariot 3 and 2 horses, a noble and a base horse, they are not distinguished along the lines of anger and desire, but of noble desire and base desire. That has to do with the fact that in the political context, the political passion, you can say, is anger, or is serious. And the proof is this, I mean, what is the political, then we would start from how I explain the political passion.
A light prospect for developing the new rhetoric, since he seems to be persuaded by Socrates, and he's also a student of Gorgias.
In other words, why is Polos persuadable?
No, why you maintain that the dialogue was directed to Gorgias? I was wondering whether there was a possibility that Polos might develop the new rhetoric.
No, Gorgias is a much greater, more gifted man. That's a very simple answer.
But yes. You did point out that Thrasymachus, the man who corresponds to Polos,
Yeah, that is true, but still, Thrasymachus was a greater man. I mean, one can easily see that from the survey of the most famous rhetoricians which Plato gives in the Phaedrus. Thrasymachus was more gifted.
Well, in the text, the discussion with Polus would be a just action, and since it wouldn't be beneficial, the punisher would be pleasant. I mean, that was the implication for it. And that sort of indicate that Polis would have a place in a good society as sort of a prosecuting attorney or something that he could be this.
Yeah, well, there are infinite. Yeah. I mean, in other words, once we have realized, which is not so easy, but which one can, that the best regime simply, absolutely according to nature, according to which the best man should live, is the rule of philosophy. These famous speeches of philosophy. Once we have realized that this is not only improbable, but because if it is probable, we still might try to get it, but that it is strictly speaking impossible, then we have, then we would know a crucial truth about the polis as polis, why the polis as polis simply is incompatible with the notion of being ruled by philosophy. Then we would have to accept and to cling to the Platonic line, you must understand this intelligently or symbolically, we must have, we must accept a society with private property, with an inequality of the sexes, and some other unfortunate things. Yeah? You know? And then, of course, naturally, there will be law courts, that goes without saying. And then there is, of course, the question of whether a decent man, simply because he is inarticulate, will not have a ghost of a chance against an articulate scoundrel. There must therefore be honest men who are willing, for a remuneration, I fear, to defend that poor man before law court, and this is a perfectly respectable profession, yeah? As we all know. If it is truly practiced in the spirit, which is not always the case. And then, surely, but and that is the basis of Aristotle's rhetoric. Since he admits these commonsensical propositions, he says, well, let us see what a good forensic orator has to know and what he has to do, and to write the rest. That's simple. But needless to say that Aristotle does not go into the question in the rhetoric, but into the question as to the place of forensic rhetoric, or for that matter any other of the ordinary rhetoric, occupy in the whole. And that is clear from Aristotle's point of view too, they are rather lowly, more akin to swimming than, or to medicine, than to philosophy. Mr. Ryan?
Was Socrates' sharp distinction between the pleasant and the good consistent with his aim to teach Gorgias the true rhetoric, which would have to ingratiate the many?
And yeah, it was a condition for him. And to that extent, let me say this way. If the rhetoric which a man like Gorgias or say Protosimachus should practice is one which tames the demon by ingratiating itself with it, this ingratiation doesn't mean that they would flatter them in the group. That can very well mean that they appeal to their fears, you know, but still go to, they assimilate themselves with the demon. Now, this ingratiation with the demon, this consideration of the pleasures and pains as ordinarily considered, presupposes the distinction between the pleasant and the good. The highest form of rhetoric would not be concerned with ingratiation in either sense, it would be only concerned with the good. Just as the physician would say, you have to undergo this operation, whether it is painful or not is irrelevant, that's the only thing in which the way in which you can get rid of your cancer or whatever it might be. Yeah? And where a secondary art would come in the form of anesthesiology, I suppose, and would say, how can we make it as little painful as possible? Which is, of course, a perfectly sensible thing. Socrates would not deny that. But in order to give their proper right to the good on the one hand and the pleasant on the other, you must first distinguish them. And in the, is this not clear? And the second point, which is equally crucial, is that the good is a higher consideration than the pleasant.
Right.
The very simple commonsensical proof, we do not admire people for their pleasure. And we can perhaps envy them, but we do not admire them. We admire them for their goodness in the right sense, for their excellence. But or to take the most simple example, the parallel question regarding self-preservation, the highest good in some the guiding point of view in Hobbes, for example. The simple argument against that, that this is a very powerful thing in man, no sensible man would ever deny. But can it be the controlling, the overriding consideration? And I think, commonsensically speaking, we all know some men who are dead, and we do not admire quite a few people who are alive. So being alive cannot be the highest consideration of pleasure. This has to be deepened somewhat, but I think it has some weight. Of course.
Yes. Well, the teaching was too harsh in order to really be effective. He had an adopted strange as Thrasymachus to be persuaded in a dialogue that goes to the peak of justice, and in a dialogue concerned with teaching Gorgias how to use the proper rhetoric somehow for the discussion of justice. It's too harsh to be accepted. Too much of a
doubt. Yeah, but because it is a matter, the point is this. Thrasymachus becomes, in a way, persuaded. More literally, he becomes tamed by Socrates. He becomes tamed. Now, Gorgias is also tamed very soon. He sees that he is a hopeless victim in the hands of that supreme dialectician, rhetorician Socrates. Let us not, this is a very important question, the comparison of the Republic and the Gorgias, but we cannot go into that. I would like now to make a transition to what we will do now. From now on, we shall turn to a close study of the Protagoras. Now, how can we justify this? After all, we are here in a political science department. I believe almost all of you are political science students. Do not. No, I saw that. And I do not know what told me then. And, how can we justify it? We who live within the turmoil of 1965, confronted with such pressing questions as Vietnam and the civil rights issue. In both cases, we find groups of men fighting for their interests. I take now a very unpatriotic view of the South Vietnamese, or of the South Vietnamese Communist Party. We find groups of men fighting for their interests, and at the same time appealing to ideas. Is it not hopeless to expect any light from Plato for the understanding of these contemporary phenomena? After all, Plato, in his analysis of the political man in the Gorgias, reduced the political man to the lowest possible denominator. You remember? He is ultimately a man concerned with his belly and nothing else. That would be as grossly unfair as trying to explain a phenomenon like Stalin in terms of the famous suppers in the Kremlin, with lots of vodka and caviar, which you all have read, and also in terms of the glee which he felt when he heard of the execution of his opponent. There are some ghastly stories about that. But still, I would say, however abominable that man may be, that simply is not sufficient for understanding it, because there are other people who have these terrible qualities and lack certain qualities which Stalin possesses. Now, if we look then, how could Plato go so far in depreciating the political man as he did in the Buddha? Now, the revolutionary movements of our time all point back to the French Revolution. The peculiarity of the French Revolution was well described by Burke in well-known passages. My Hegel, you remember what we read? In the French Revolution, man for the first time tried to stand on his head. But let me read to you a man somewhat closer to us, who has been a very close student of the French Revolution, Alexis de Tocqueville, in his book on the Ancien Régime. All civil and political revolutions have had a fatherland and have closed themselves within the fatherland. The French Revolution did not have a proper territory of its own. On the contrary, its effect has rather been, in a, so to speak, to efface from the map all ancient frontiers. Read all the annals of history. You will not find a single political revolution which has the same character. You will find it only in certain religious revolutions. The French Revolution is a political revolution which has operated in the manner and which has in a way taken the aspect of a religious revolution. Look by which particular traits and characteristics it achieved to resemble to religious revolution. Not only does it expand outside as the religious revolution, but like them, it penetrates outside through preaching and propaganda. A political revolution which inspires proselytism, which one preaches as ardently to strangers as one accomplishes it with passion at home. Consider what novel spectacle. Among all unknown things that the French Revolution has shown to the world, this is surely the most novel. The French Revolution has operated with regard to this world precisely in the same manner as the religious revolutions act with a view to the other world. It has considered the citizens in an abstract manner, outside all the particular societies, just as their religions consider men in general, independently of country and time. The French Revolution has sought not merely what is the peculiar right of the French citizens, but what are the duties and general rights of men in political matters. And then I read to you only one more heading of a chapter later on. How it came that toward the middle of the 18th century, men of letters became the principal political men of the country and the effects which resulted from this. Now, in developing this, it becomes clear, Tocqueville makes clear that these men of letters called themselves and were called philosophers. So this the French Revolution is the first revolution tending towards the regeneration of the human race by its own power in this world, the first philosophic revolution. That is the same thing what Burke, of course, said very early. So I just took Tocqueville for some reason of convenience. Hence, the French Revolution was based on a new, since both politics and philosophy existed long time before the French Revolution, The French Revolution was based on a new view of the relation of philosophy and politics. It cannot be understood if one does not see it in contrast with the old view. The old view, one can say, it's a pre-French Revolution, expected less of politics than the new view. For example, no regeneration of human race. Now, this has, of course, this is a simple historical fact which I think everyone will admit. But it is not completely deprived of practical consequences regarding the issue, the basic issues of our time. The issue is this: what kind of solution can possibly be expected, whether it is in foreign affairs or in domestic affairs? This is the fundamental question. Whether such goals as the regeneration of the human race, to use the phrase used by Tocqueville, you can also use other one, is a possible goal of politics. Now, the closest approximation to this new, it goes without saying that this view didn't emerge with the philosophers of the 18th century, French philosophers, but the least one would have to say is to read Descartes, who has been called rightly the grandfather of the French Revolution. Still, it was even older. The closest approximation to the new view within earlier philosophy is, in a way, Plato's Republic, especially Book 5. That if the philosophers become kings, evil will cease from the human. The implication is the evils, all evils will cease from the human race. So this much is clear. If we want to have the greatest possible clarity about what is going on before our eyes, we have to dig and go back to the thought of the past. Are we then to say that the radical change within philosophy, political philosophy, is at the bottom of what is going on today in Vietnam and in Selma, Alabama?
I read to you another text which approaches me,
and this is Karl Marx from the German ideology. I have it here only in German, unfortunately, and it's even in the fundamental thing is of the life process, the social economic process. Also the formations of forms in the brains of men are necessary sublimation of their life process, which is of their material life process, meaning concerned with tangible, which can be studied and observed empirically, and which is based on material presuppositions. Material meaning, again, tangible. Morality, religion, metaphysics, and other ideologies cease to have the appearance of independence. They have no history. They have no development. But men who develop their material production and their material exchange change together with that also their thoughts and the products of their thoughts. It is not consciousness which determines life, but life determines consciousness. You may hear the play consciousness by thought. Not thought is not thought which determines life, but life determines thought. Now let me see. There where speculation, metaphysics as we call it, stops, Namely, when we come to realize the real positive science begins. The presentation of the practical activity of the practical process of development of men. The mere phrases of consciousness stop. Genuine knowledge must take their place. Independent philosophy loses its medium of existence at the same time when this presentation of reality comes to the fore. Yeah, you all know this, but I thought I should remind you of the very formulation of Marx. Philosophy is only a weak reflex of socio-economic changes. And this view has, of course, had a terrific success beyond Marxism itself. But is it an accident that such reflexes are produced? Not at all. Marx says it is necessary. Man is, after all, strange as it may sound, a thinking animal. He cannot help producing these brain of foggy notions in his mind. Yes, very well. How do we know that the philosophies are mere reflexes of the socio-economic process? With all due respect for Marx, his saying so doesn't settle it. I discussed in an earlier seminar on a detailed study by a Marxist. I think I can say this without any hesitation. Yeah, I'm sure he's not a card-carrying communist or anything like that. Macpherson's book on possessive individualism, meaning chiefly Hobbes and Locke. We discussed it at some length. Now, he following the Marxist principle, but carrying it through in a way in which is not ordinarily carried through by Marxists, observes contradictions in the doctrine, say in the Hobbesian doctrine, and asserts that this contradiction can be explained only by the fact that Hobbes identified society with capitalist society. Here we see the dependence of a philosophy on a specific stage of society. Well, I do not wish to assert my view of Macpherson's proof. I would only say, all right, minor, let us see. And nothing, as Socrates used to say, nothing like having another look at it. In order to prove the Marxist interpretation of the history of thought, we have to begin with studying the doctrines as such. The manifest as that which is first for us. Even if Marxist right that it is not the first in itself, as the first in itself as a socio-economic addition, but Marx doesn't claim that he had a divine revelation. He claims that this is a matter which can be rationally decided. That is to that. I believe this simple reasoning is unimpeachable. That even if Marx were right, it would be absolutely necessary to test it. And to test it would mean to study the history of thought in a long term. And now then it's a very simple further step. If we have to study these doctrines, we must study them properly. And not in a glib, brash manner. Probably, exactly, carefully. I will give you an example rather far more from what we are doing in this quarter, but because the principle is truly universal. One of the most discussed classics of political philosophy in this country is Locke's Civil Government. But very, very few students of Lok Sivarigaman, ever study the first treatise. You know, the book consists of two parts. The well-known positive work is the second. The first is the critique of Filmer. But Lok himself says, right at the beginning of the work, that's the second, but it's too long to read. As all these premises, he says that the whole second treatise is based on the argument of the first. How can one neglect it, that no one today is interested in divine right of kings? There are no longer any kings around to speak of. And it doesn't mean that it was not of crucial importance to Locke. I mean, I regard this as absolutely elemental. And I hope you see that point, that if it is for one reason or another necessary to study Locke, if it is, then one has to make an effort to understand Locke and not a figment of our imagination, which means Locke who doesn't care, who is in no way interested in the issue of divine right. So this is, I think, a good starting point. We must study carefully. But here a great difficulty arises. What degree of care? Does it make sense to apply the same degree of care in the case, say, of a pamphlet printed in a revolutionary exciting epoch, which was already of no importance the next day, or a book of this magnitude? You know, a superficial and narrow pamphlet doesn't deserve the care which a profound and deep work deserves. And then there is another difference, which is also important. If we limit ourselves only to the worthwhile books, there are books which set forth the doctrine in a straightforward manner. Say, as Hegel in his Philosophy of Freiburg, and John Stuart Mill, of course. But there may also be books which do not set forth the doctrine in a straightforward manner. Prior to examination, we cannot exclude them. Now, this is clearly the case of Plato. In his dialogue Phaedrus, he speaks, which is the dialogue, an erotic speech. He speaks of the essential defect of writing. Writing is a bad invention. Socrates didn't write books. The dialogues, but Plato did write books in the dialogues. And I conclude the dialogues must be writings which are free from the defects of writing. What are the defects of writing? As Socrates says in the context, writing says the same thing to all readers. And in the implication is writing should not say the same thing to all readers. The Platonic dialogues are meant to say different things to different readers. But to speak with a view to the capacity, character, social standing, and all the other things which may be important of a man, with a view ad hominem, with a view to the individual, this is one strict meaning of the word irony in Plato's language. So in this sense, all Platonic dialogues are ironic, which doesn't mean, of course, the silly notion of irony, that if you see a limping man and say, what a wonderful runner, that goes without saying. But if we start from this, then of course it is a very great question, how can we find out what Plato meant in a non-ironical way, i.e. what he would have told us if he had made sure that we are serious people sufficiently prepared. And the answer that is given also in the Phaedrus. Plato speaks here of the thing which he calls logographic necessity, the necessity governing the writing of speeches, and of course books are only written. In a good book, as Plato understands it. Everything is necessary. Also with the place there, doctrine. And therefore, these works have to be read with the utmost care. And therefore, if I seem to lose myself and to induce you to lose yourself in what at first glance looks like minute observation, I can only ask you be a bit patient. From my experience hitherto, I have seen that it pays to be patient. But it takes some time sometimes to see it. I believe even if you would study exactly the most exciting things in South Vietnam or in Selma, Alabama, you would also have to develop a habit of patience to get the same truth out of it. And so, therefore, the request is not unequitable. I'm sorry.
I think when one reads it carefully, one sees there is a discussion probably there, the second book and later on that one, that while in one respect the poet must listen to the legislator, yeah? And if the legislator tells him, say, no, maybe federal stuff, he must obey. Yeah? But in another respect, the legislator must listen to the poet. Because the legislator, as legislator, does not necessarily have that understanding of the nature, the character of man, which is the poet. The apology is the most popular statement of God. You know, I mean, the apology is a dialogue, as you said there. And, of course, a compulsory dialogue, if you know what I mean. I mean, he sort of didn't enjoy having it. It wasn't imposed on him. And secondly, it was the only conversation recorded between Socrates and the city of Athens as a whole. And that is not. And Socrates himself gave the commentary on the apology in the Gorgias when he described how a wise man would act if accused by the demon of improprieties of one kind. And he says this very simply. He is the situation of a physician who is accused by children of being unnice to them. That the cook gives them all the candy, you know, and they like the cook. And then they come to the wicked physician with his skill and with his cutting, you know, and they hate him. And he, of course, can never explain to the children what is truly going on because they wouldn't understand it. That is truly stated what is going on in the apology. That cannot be used. No. That doesn't mean that one mustn't read the apology most carefully. But I think the most careful reading of the apology would only concern that. That is as a poet, the true competitor of Plato are not the sophists. I mean, because they are simply inferior. Nor the politicians or the statesmen or legislators, but the poets. They are, and that can be proven very simply, because what are the poets dealing with? Then he takes it up in from the 10th book. They have in a way the same subject as Plato. And the only one to do that.
Mr. Hoffman?
Isn't the passion between law of descent and the question of descent? Is it good to do with a good to do?
Yeah, I don't know whether it's more direct, there's a more direct connection, but when Plato uses the word tragic, it invariably means something like, on the surface it means, yeah, wrong and erring in the direction of bombast. Bombastic. For example, the amino that is present, amino acid is still very thick, or I forgot now, a definition of color is given, I think, by third. On the basis of the impediment, if I remember that. And so it says that the traffic definition. And that means high sounding and wrong. Wrong is the way of high sounding, soundingness. That's all this in this sense. But that, of course, doesn't settle the question of what Plato thought of tragedy. It's only it's an opening, an opening for a big question. And I think one can say that. That if you take the two forms of tragedy, the drama, tragedy and comedy, there is a slight edge in favor of comedy, in favor. But that is by no means so simple, because in the banquet, the man, I mean, there is a sequence of speeches, you know, and culminating in Socrates. The one immediate preceding Socrates is the traffic point, and he only is preceded by the common point. And Agathos, a traffic point somehow akin in its form to Euripides, and that is a long question. I mean, of course, one could say that this external difference is not decided. Socrates' speech is the central speech of the banquet, and that might be the most important. That is, and there is that is long, would always require a very long study, you know. And we cannot. We would first have to find out what is a tragedy according to Plato. We cannot ascribe to Plato as Aristotle's definition of tragedy, you know. At least not without having that upon his word. And Plato speaks only of the immense popularity of tragedy, very emphatically, at least in the law, surely, and also in another place which some people think is curious, and most people think is curious. But he doesn't develop clearly what is tragedy in contradistinction to comedy. A few allusions which are not sufficient on the surface. Did Homer know which ships and which groups of people all came to Troy, the second book of the Iliad? How do you know?
Well,
he wasn't present, so he calls on the muses.
The muses were actually
speaking with the muses. Yeah, but this awkwardness happens also in Homer's face. I mean, perhaps you could say that he calls on the muses, and then you sing, so-and-so, and then you sing. Yeah, but I don't believe that. I believe Homer has it. Would you also share this belief?
Yeah,
I think also the invention of the species is there. I mean, not only, he was not psychic, secretary of the muses. Socrates doesn't do this ordinarily. If he does this, then he comes to a subject where he cannot possibly have knowledge. He wasn't present, was he? After all, the most simple explanation of why an invasion is needed, because we were not present. Homer wasn't present. More clearly developed by the way Nietzsche. When Nietzsche described farming in his Western days, and he was a farmer. He tells people how to farm, which days are propitious, and so on and so on. But when he comes to sailing, another way of earning one's livelihood, the economy to use, because what you say that? The music tells you what you, I mean, music knowledge, knowledge coming from the music, is knowledge not available either to man or to man, or to this particular man. In other words, the question would be, why does he call on the music here and nowhere else, at least in the public? Yeah? That's it. Apparently, that is the most difficult question to see the origin of the decay. Yeah? The origin of the decay. But this implies, implies that we know that the best regime was present at the beginning, i.e. there was a golden age in the highest sense of the term, you know. Then he mentions a statement. In the statement where the myth of a golden age is used, it is left open whether that is a golden age. They had everything in abundance. But whether they were happy people or not, they are explained as well, I don't know, because I do not know whether they philosophized or not. So that's very useless, that that was truly the golden age. But here we have true perfection at the beginning. How can we know that? Yeah. Only someone who was an eyewitness of the beginning. And the music, the daughter of Zeus, surely there. Not perfectly logical. I mean, isn't that an absolutely necessary conclusion if you grant certain premises? How can you know about the beginning? Let us take a infinitely more solemn statement. The first chapter of Genesis. Yeah? Who wrote that? Who wrote that? If it isn't you, it's God wrote it. And that is, of course, perfectly sound treatment. Who can describe the creation of the world? No human being can. Because no human being could have been present. And therefore, the traditional assertion that this was written under divine inspiration is, I think, an indispensable one given to come. We are no longer accustomed to this way of thinking, but in its place, of course, it questions everything here. The interesting question to repeat is, I believe, the only why are the music involved here and nowhere else in the Republic, and I believe has to been mastered. Because this is, I mean, what human reason can do, the utmost it can do, is to prove the possibility of the best of this. The actuality could be proven only if we have documents from the recorded past. Yeah? Say somewhere in Crete. All right, let's go to Crete, what they do in the law. But if it is here the assertion that it was active at the beginning, the most beginnings of the human race, that cannot be known except through you. I mean, that could be story, myth, but it is not called myth.
I wonder what the curious number that comes in that doesn't reinforce that. I mean,
it's most disgusting for me, what you say. I think it was oblivious of them at the moment. That the natural number is part of the music account.
How much
is the people that you see? So ordinary conversation, you see. Once you know that the best regime was the original regime, then it follows that all other regimes are degenerating. And the order of the degeneration that is supposed to be so that it establishes by its own reasoning. If the best was at the beginning, it makes sense to say that the second best came at the second place, the third place in the third place, and the lowest not. I think that's clear from the text, then. Because you know there are certain principles which Sukadeva establishes. For example, there's one-to-one correspondence of policy and regime, and the principle that every regime decays only through decay of the ruling power. These are established in the concept. Oh, yes. Yes, it's a good question. I mean, there is a parallel, I never thought of it. It is a parallel question to the question which we discussed and mentioned in a formal occasion, how to tell a myth, a platonic myth, from a platonic lover. And the safest thing is, of course, not to follow one's own impressions. But when Plato says it is a myth, it is, or so it is a myth. Failing that, you know. So the public, of course, is called frequently a myth into the public, you know. What they are doing is telling a myth. It's just that is in the law of Plato. Well, in this particular course, I have not stressed this point because we would never find an end to any meeting if we would stress every important point. But in the former course, I remember that was one of the themes of the course. What is the cognitive status of the public according to Plato, according to Socrates, and where the question of myth became, of course, crucial. Yes. Now that's the last one.
Yeah, there's 2 points in the sense that here in
it seems to be a singular.
Single what?
Single development.
Yes.
That's the same thing.
This
notion of return to return is clear, but whether these things which you refer are proof of it, I doubt it. I think you would find it more clearly in the third book of the law.
Yes.
Good. So, next. Here is the book line. Mr. Stack.